Okay, well, thank you very much for the invitation to speak. What I'm going to talk about here is very much work in progress. The idea came about during some work on uses of data from the National Population Health Survey of Statistics Canada. So it's looking increasingly likely that we won't actually be able to apply what we're thinking about very easily to that data. Nevertheless, that was the origin of the problem. And this is a longitudinal survey on health and health behavior, which started in 1994. They had, I think, about 17,000 respondents enrolled at the beginning. There are interviews at two-year intervals, and the attrition is relatively minor. They put a great deal of work into retention of these respondents. There's the potential, at least, for the recall of event times of various types in the interviews. And sometimes these would be recalled to within an interval. So the question that we're looking at arises when you might be interested in relationships among events of different types, and these relationships that were probably not in the minds of the people actually designing the survey and the instrument and so on. So we might be interested in trying to make inference about the temporal order of event times. For instance, to ask in attempting to sort out causal relationships, is it helpful to be able to show a tendency for one kind of event to follow another? An example, it's plausible that becoming pregnant triggers smoking cessation or cessation attempts for some women. In fact, we know of individual cases where this is actually the case. So a question might be whether one can observe this in the survey population as a whole, and whether we might be able to devise a test for the event of a pregnancy tending to precede the event of attempting to stop smoking. So I'm going to talk about a little bit about some ideas of temporal association and ordering, first of all. And then, although some of these might best be addressed by parametric or semi-parametric models, I'm going to talk about non-parametric testing for these kinds of order concepts, and then see what happens when interval censoring is introduced and how it might be possible to adapt the ideas to that case. So I'm going to say that temporal order and association are related but not the same thing, and illustrate with some definitions for duration time distributions, although there would be similar definitions available for event processes. So we could say, for example, thinking just of association of event times, that T1 and T2 are weakly associated if they're positively correlated. A stronger type of association might be that knowing that K capital T1 is greater than little t1 pushes the survivor function of T2 along, I guess. Am I saying along? No, the other way. So I have an expression there, probably the survivor function for T2 given T1 greater than T1 is greater than the marginal probability T2 greater than T2. And this condition is easily seen to be equivalent to the relationship between the joint survivor function and the product of the marginals. So that's a stronger notion of association, which is a property of the joint distribution. If we talk about time order, this looks like sort of bad language, but I'm talking in terms of precursor here. And of course, one notion of order is a strict order, that we could say that if T2 minus T1 is a non-negative random variable, then T1 is a strict precursor of T2. But there are also definitions which are analogous to the weak and strong association that I introduced on the previous screen. So we could say that T1 is a weak precursor of T2 if the probability that T1 is less than T2 under the joint distribution is greater than the corresponding probability under the assumption of independence with the same marginals of T1 and T2. Or that T1 is a strong precursor of T2 if survivor function for T2 is affected by T1. In the sense of pushing T2 along in that case. So an example where we might have a strong precursor relationship. A simple example is where T2 would be a mixture of a sum of T1 plus another exponential variable, and then another exponential variable. So the first component, there would be a strict ordering and then there would be another non-ordered component. So in that case, the survivor function would have that property. So it's fairly easy to see that a strict precursor is a strong precursor, and a strong precursor is a weak precursor. If you're really interested in the connection between events in time, closeness obviously means something. The causal relationship is more plausible, perhaps, if T2 follows T1 closely or tends to. So we could think of a definition also of close precursor, which actually is not implied by the others. That essentially T1 happening increases the hazard of T2 immediately for a time. And this notion is actually even more useful when we talk about time order for event processes. it's related to the, some of the ideas I think that are expressed in a paper by Blosfeld and Mills, who talk about interrelated event processes and pay special attention to what they call the temporal unfolding of an effect. So if we were trying to do non-parametric testing for precursor relationships of these types, one possibility would be to set up test statistics which would sort of measure the extent of those inequalities in the definitions. So for a strong precursor relationship, we could examine the relationship between conditional survivor function and marginal survivor function. Perhaps integrated with respect to the empirical survivor function of T1. There would be a similar sort of thing one could construct for a notion of close precursor. And these statistics involve, to a limited extent anyway, the estimation of the joint distribution of T1 and T2. But not necessarily the whole joint distribution. We might, however, also be interested in something in a way simpler and more graphical, tied to the notion of the weak precursor, where we might want simply to compare the empirical distribution of T2 minus T1 with its distribution under the independence assumption but the same marginals. So T2 minus T1 can be a kind of an interesting object, and one example that was a little bit motivated by the pregnancy smoking abstract notion was to take a certain observation interval, zero to 2 years, say, and allow T1 to have a constant hazard rate, 0.1, T2 to have a hazard rate, 0.05, before T1 and 0.15 after T1 for a short time, say 0.5 time units. T1 is both a weak precursor and a close precursor of T2. It's probably a strong precursor as well. And the true density of T2 minus T1 would look like the thing on the left, so it would be it would have a discontinuity at zero. And the independence density, these are not to scale, but the independence density would be something like the one on the right. So obviously different in nature, and would be interesting to compare estimates of those things. And in order to do that, in order to estimate both of those, with complete data, it's obviously fairly straightforward. And if we have interval censoring coming up, things are a little more difficult. And as I said at the beginning, in these longitudinal surveys, it's possible that the questions may be asked in such a way as to give us an interval for the event, but not necessarily a time for the event. And one example is the time of smoking cessation in the NPHS, where the respondent is asked, at what age did you stop? So you could actually tell to within a variable length of time, depending on the relationship of the person's birthday to the time of the interview, I guess. So if you had something like that, and also some kind of ability to infer within a reasonably small interval the time of becoming pregnant, you could consider testing for one of these order relationships between T1 and T2. And again, to apply the tests, we need an estimate of the joint distribution of T1 and T2. So at this point, I think it was only, starting to think about this, it was only a couple of months after hearing a talk about the method of, as it then was, Duchesne and Stafford on estimation of densities from randomly interval censored data. And you've already seen from Jamie's talk the basic idea of this. So I can skip over this fairly quickly, but the kernel density estimate version involves replacing essentially KH of XI minus X with the expectation of that same term conditional on XI belonging to the interval that's observed. And then the density is found iteratively. And the conditional expectation itself is constructed from the current estimate of the density, and then the as Jamie described. So this was particularly appealing, not only because it's a very neat idea and for all the reasons that Jamie talked about, but also it's something that one could imagine applying to complex survey data, where you have survey weights and complex designs and so on, because it's essentially based on sample sums. So it's something which would be, as far as we can tell, quite easily adaptable to complex surveys. And moreover, with care and work, it seems to be adaptable to the estimation of bivariate distributions, as well as of course, univariate ones. And I guess, conceptually at least, that you wouldn't really have to restrict the density, the dimension. So this is part of Norberto's PhD work, which he's beginning. He's worked out something of a generalization to the bivariate case, where you consider essentially product kernels for the integration kernel. And then consider that the interval sensor data, which is now being called XI, which is two-dimensional, lies in a two-dimensional interval. And we assume that it's randomly censored, and also the two intervals are essentially independently generated. It's obvious that if we're talking about times that are close together and subject to the same interval censoring, that we might not be able to tell too much about their relationship. But at least conceptually, if you have a large enough sample and sufficiently much variation in the interval censoring process, it intuitively it should be possible to recover a certain amount of information about the order. Then we also were very interested in the local log likelihood extension because of the fact that our joint distribution may have some strange properties, sort of internal boundaries or a discontinuity, and it would be interesting to try to adapt this to the case of densities with these kinds of special behavior at zero or along a line in a two-dimensional space. There was a paper recently won the Canadian Journal of Statistics Award for 2003 by Abdus et al., where they develop a method for looking at densities that have a discontinuity at the origin but are otherwise, in a sense, symmetric or near symmetric. And what you do if your density is, say, A0 plus from the right and A0 minus from the left, you rescale the observations to the left so that the density of the transformed data is continuous. Then you estimate that density, and then you transform back, and you'll have an estimated density which captures the discontinuity. So it wouldn't, in this case, capture the discontinuity of the derivative, but that might not be such a serious problem. So again, I guess we can think of applying in the bivariate case if we try a local linear log likelihood. We would probably want to consider as special the directions corresponding to T2 minus T1 and T1 plus T2. One final note, if you're computing these conditional expectations using Monte Carlo integration, for a single dimension usual Monte Carlo methods and important sampling can be applied when we're generalizing to two dimensions, it becomes a a fairly appealing thing to use some kind of uniform sampling scheme. So we've actually been looking so far at using the scheme proposed by Tang, which is based on orthogonal arrays and Latin hypercube sampling, but some sort of uniform sampling scheme which resembles the picture on the left seems to be advisable in terms of assisting with the computation of the conditional expectations. So we certainly have been very grateful to Jamie for his assistance so far in implementing this, and planning to explore it further. Thank you.